Welcome to Passion and Purpose, a podcast with Jimmy Seibert and the Antioch Movement. Whether this is your first time with us or you've been with us for a while now, our desire is that by the end of our time together, you can say that you've fallen more in love with Jesus and have a greater passion for Him and His purposes in the earth. Thanks so much for joining us. We hope that you enjoy today's episode.
Well, hey, everybody. Welcome back to Passion and Purpose. I just love doing this stuff, Mick, because it's that casual opportunity just to talk about Jesus, what he's doing among us. And one of the things you guys know, if you're watching this, that we've been talking about is unpacking the word of the Lord to us is an Antioch Movement for 2024 to be a multi-generational family on mission. And I love everything about that, from Adam and Eve to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to the people of Israel, to the New Testament church, to when we see Jesus face to face, every tribe, tongue, people, nation. We are, will be a multi-generational family on mission forever and ever, and I love it. So we've been unpacking it over the last few weeks. We've been talking about covenant in Scripture. We've been talking about what's the purpose of the New Testament church. How do we respond in relationships? But you and I were talking this morning about this whole idea of the Western culture versus an Eastern culture in relationship to understanding multi-generational relationships. And if you're already saying, now, what are these guys going to? Hang on, I want to give you a little story, and then I'm going to team Mick up to talk a little bit about what are the unique challenges for us as Western believers in really learning what it means to supernaturally or naturally be the family of God, what God's called us to be. But the story we were talking about, I was in Spain last week, and I was with this guy from Australia. And he grew up Indian background guy. His family was were Christians that came from southern India. So all his growing up years were Australia. He had become a very successful businessman at a young age, did really, really well, had a really incredible encounter with the Lord in his late 20s, and God has been using him powerfully through northern India, everything from education to business to healthcare, and obviously to church planting and disciple making. So really, really cool guy. And when I meet people that God's using, I try to just learn every time I can. Man, and I just want to say that to everybody. You can learn from anybody all the time if you want to. Like, God is speaking through people's failures, through their successes, through their watching them sin, let alone the glory of God and the beauty of God. So I can learn all the time if my heart posture is, God, I want to see, I want to hear, I want to understand. So I'm with this guy and he's telling me his story and I'm just like, wow. And so I asked him, I said, hey, we've got this word of the Lord. We're this multi-generational family on mission. What does that mean to you? How do you see it? And he said, well, I have the benefit of coming from an Indian family, but I grew up in the West. We grew up in Australia. And he said, in our house, my grandfather lived there. My dad, of course, we, the kids, live there. Today, my wife and I live next door. So in one way, and my kids now know their great-grandfather. So we literally have four generations living within proximity of one another. And he said, I never saw my grandfather and my father argue about who's in charge of what. They didn't have lists of clarity. They didn't have to have discussions on who was taking what role when.
Right.
But we all knew, like when I was really little, Grandpa was the head of the house. And but you could see more and more my dad became the head of the house. But nobody ever told us when that transition happened. And then Grandpa became the one that would just hang out with us. And in key family decisions, he would be brought in. But they understood the dance of multi-generational family because they had one goal in mind, that was to make the next generation great. Like Grandpa's desire was my dad to be a man of God, the head of the house, a provider, a leader, a Christian influence. So everything he did was not to dominate my father, but to empower him and to help him. And at times he had to be strong when my dad was younger to help him get there. But there was never a question of what the motive was. My dad's only motive was for me and my siblings to succeed in our character, our Christian witness, but also our vocations. And they were always for us. And the same thing for our kids. And he said it was interesting because it was set in the context of growing up in an Australian environment where it's extremely independent. And the goal is, how quickly can everybody be independent? And therefore, there was always conflict in homes and conflict in families, and people didn't understand each other. And their goal was to move away from their family instead of benefit from their family. And as I sat there and listened to him, it was late at night, actually, we were having this conversation. I was just sitting there thinking, you know, for Laura and I, when we got married, we had more the independent model, and the goal was to move away from your parents, for them to be proud of you for making it on your own.
Right? Out of the nest. Yep.
Yeah. And we had quote unquote successfully done that part, but we weren't that close to our parents. And when we got married and started having kids, and we looked at the scriptures and we looked at healthy multi-generational families, we said, you know, we want to be biblical. We want to be a biblical family, not just an American family. Mm-hmm. And we want to love our kids for their good, not just for our benefit. And our hope is that our kids are greater than us. And by greatness, that does not mean in the world's eyes, but in their character, in their witness, in their love for God, and their love for others, and of course, their contribution to the world around them. But sitting there with that guy, it's just kind of like things went slow motion again for me. And I'm like, okay, this thing that God's speaking to us about is bigger than just an interesting
theological concept.
Or just something, man, wouldn't it be neat to be a really warm family in our movement or whatever? It matters to God's plan and purpose for the world. So, hey, talk to me a little bit about Western, Eastern constructs. Where do you think we've missed it as families? Obviously, we got to observe the problem. And give us some thoughts on how do we fix this thing?
Yeah. Yeah, I would say it's not just Eastern, Western, but ancient, modern as well. And there's a couple things going on in my mind. One is, yeah, you talk about this posture of, like, I want the next generation to succeed and go beyond where we have. And one of the shifts, and if you're listening and you're interested in these sorts of things, Carl Truman's book, The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self, really breaks this down in an accessible way. Strange New World is another shorter work of his. But he talks about how sociologists look at how have people gotten their identity throughout the ages. And, you know, if you go all the way back to the time of Jesus, it was tribal. You were part of an entity that was much bigger than yourselves. The sociologists call that the political man, that you were kind of part of the polis, part of the larger ethnic identity.
Right.
And you lived to serve the longevity of whatever people you were part of. And that would certainly include your family, your clan. Other examples throughout the ages have been the religious man who was part of a religious system, you know, whether that was Christianity or Islam, but I'm part of something bigger than myself. Yes. And I'm trying to advance its agenda and narrative and not just my own. Or economic man, where I'm part of a business or a corporation. And really, since the Enlightenment, we are now an anomaly where we don't find our primary identity in these larger groups that that we're seeking to benefit at the cost of our own well-being. Now we are independent man. We are psychological man, where my internal world is more constitutive of what's real than my family, the church in our context, an educational institution, a company, a corporation. So we are atomized, is a word you'll hear, you know, thrown around in sociological circles, where we have become so individualized apart from a larger entity that we're untethered in that sense. Mm-hmm. So that's one component. But what we were talking about this morning was the other shift that happened in the Enlightenment was this thinking from, you know, really not even just a Christian thought, but pre-Christian, that each individual person is flawed. You know, we would call it original sin. Mm-hmm. And talking about, like, Augustine, who wrote about, you know, his theft of the pears, and he located the reason for that theft in himself, his sin. Around the time of the Enlightenment, you know, it really gained traction that if there is no God, then there was no framework for original sin. And so you see all these thinkers grappling with, well, where is the locus of the breakdown of society? Well, it has to be out there. It's not in here in me.
Big, so, huge.
Yes, huge. So the shift went from, as a child, I'm born into this family and I need to conform to the expectations of the family. Well, now, if it's the family who is corrupt because they've been older longer, the child comes in, tabula rasa, the blank slate, John Locke. If the child is a blank slate, then it is the most pure form. And so you get this shift from the kind of the reverence of the wisdom of the aged to this cult of youth, where the younger you are, the more uncorrupted you are. The older you get, the more corrupted you become. And so you have this inversion of a family structure. And, you know, if you read people like Jean-Jacques Rousseau and Percy Bysshe Shelley and other romantics of that period, they romanticized a return to nature, a dissolution of the family, a dissolution of the church, all these structures that were perpetuating the breakdown in society. And we are byproducts in some ways in the West of that type of thinking, to where we want to self-actualize, self-promote, self-discover. And these other entities are impediments to my own advancement, my own self-discovery. Because to be in relationship is to require some kind of sacrifice.
Like, yes.
We have to, in order to have a healthy relationship in a family, I have to give something of myself for the betterment of somebody else. Well, that's an impediment if I'm trying to discover and actualize, self-actualize.
Right.
And so, yeah, we see this tension today in the church and in so many different contexts. You know,
sure.
The family is one where you have such a high divorce rate, or like you talk about, even in a healthy family, kids that are disconnected from the help of their parents as they become adults and they start raising kids themselves, or in the church, you know, the local church, like the church shopping and the church hopping. That what does it really mean to stay tethered to a local church as a church family? Now, it's different than a nuclear family, of course, but there's, I think, something for us to reflect on as Western modern believers, and so many other ramifications. But those
sure.
are some of the thoughts.
Yeah,
that we're talking
huge. So let's start with the nuclear family construct, and then let's go to the spiritual family.
Mm-hmm.
So, in the nuclear family, that independence construct is then the child becomes the center of the world, not just for their betterment, but that we wouldn't impede any mm-hmm. desire that mm-hmm. they have, right? That we must give them what they want so that they can self-discover, so that they can self-actualize, and therefore then be selfish.
Yeah. Yeah.
How about, I mean, that's really mm-hmm. the end of that train is right. A selfish child, mm-hmm. right? Versus this very real, hey, you are beautiful and an important mm-hmm. part of a whole. Mm-hmm. And we will attend to your needs as they're acute in your early years when you can't walk and talk. But the more you're able to walk and talk, the more you will become a contributing part of this greater whole of, in a Christian context, glorifying God and honoring God with our lives. And we serve one another. We connect with one another. We engage one another. And I love what you said about self-sacrifice, because one of the things that we did raising our kids, we had one privilege along the way was we built this house in a underserved neighborhood. We got a really good deal. As you can imagine, living across the street from a crack house, there's some good properties for sale
right.
there. And we built this house, and we made sure that all the three bedrooms kind of faced each other upstairs.
Mm-hmm.
And we always had people live with us, so we had downstairs for them. But to keep the nuclear family at least connected, and then we wanted instead of our kids to have individual rooms, we wanted the boys to have a room and share, and we wanted the girls to share.
Right.
And it wasn't just for economic reasons. It wasn't just for we only have so much square footage or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It was purposeful
mm-hmm.
because we needed them to learn to be unselfish as a part of an entity, so that when they had roommates, when they eventually were to marry or have kids, that they knew that life was a mutual experience. So even little things like that became very intentional in our minds. And I can't tell you how many times we would just do a timeout in the family and say, hey, this world is not all about you,
mm-hmm.
right? So look around you. Everybody else here matters. One funny story was my daughter, Lauren, when she was, I don't know, must have been about 10 or something, our youth pastors were going to an event and she wanted to ride with them. So she rode with them and we get 3 hours later to this event and the youth pastors come and they say, man, Lauren just talks up a storm. She's so talkative. And we commented on, we said, Lauren, we didn't notice you were the quietest of the Cyber family. She said, well, everybody else talks so much, I don't have a chance.
Right.
I like to talk, actually.
Yes.
And that made us aware that as parents, we needed to serve everyone. So we put a new rule in at the table as we would, you know, share about our days. Everybody gets 3 minutes limit,
mm-hmm.
Caleb. 3 minutes limit.
Yeah.
So you can start the story, but it's going to end in 3 minutes.
Yes.
Because now Lauren will talk for 3 minutes. And if she only uses one, we're going to ask her questions for the other two.
Right.
And that kind of mutual serving, though it sounds trite in light of this big cultural construct we just talked about, these are the kind of little things that allow us to become interdependent individuals mm-hmm. that allow us then to be servants and integrators and family people and people that pull people in instead of push people away. Give me some comment on that.
Yeah. I think what you're describing is like a biblical anthropology is that people are made for connection.
Yes.
Right? We're made for connection with God. We're made for connection with other people. But again, that requires restraint.
Yes.
And in a society that values unrestrained passions, you know, and everybody else needs to to conform to me, my desires,
yeah.
to be in a healthy family, healthy set of relationships, you have to restrain your passions. You have to restrain your desires. We do something similar at our table. Our youngest wouldn't get a word in edgewise if we didn't help our other children learn to restrain their passion for communication.
Yes.
And the other thing that comes to mind is, again, a biblical anthropology. There's a belief that we as individuals need to conform to someone other than ourselves. In obviously within context of the scriptures,
right.
That's Jesus.
Yes.
So the idea is not for me to just preserve who I am, though there's a balance here because, of course,
sure.
each of us are made uniquely in the image of
yes.
God, beautiful, wonderfully
right.
made, and so on and so forth. But there's a bentness to our nature that has to be molded and shaped into the image of another, into the image of Jesus. And then at a lesser level, within the context of a family, we are yielding to one another and in one sense, conforming to a family expectation,
yes.
a set of expectations mm-hmm. that we treat people a certain way and so on. And that's among this is kind of an overgeneralized statement, but among secular thought today, that's an antiquated, outmoded
right.
way of thinking, right? That these institutions like the family, like the academy, educational institutions and so on, the church, historically, these helped to form and mold you into another image,
yes.
into the image of
right.
God.
Yeah.
Now, so often in our schools or, you know, to contradict somebody, to correct somebody, to give feedback, we were talking about that earlier as
yeah.
well, is so offensive because it's an impediment, again, to my own self-discovery, self-actualization.
Yes.
So in the context of family, you know, you're talking about even the way you constructed your house was
right.
set up to help your child not just to self-discover and self-actualize, but to
right.
be connected to others, which requires a self-sacrifice and a giving of the self.
Yeah. So again, man, there's so many trains to run down here, but let's just keep going on this kind of family of origin use, because that's a context we all understand, right?
Mm-hmm.
Everybody was born into a family, understands that construct. And when I think about this whole idea of shaping individually, but also shaping collectively, right? What is the balance of that? What does that look like? And what we would say to our kids is, look, you want to be as healthy as you can so that you can be a gift to everyone else,
mm-hmm.
right? So my self-care
to love God appropriately, to restrain my passions, to submit to God, to use my gifts rightly for the glory of God, is the best thing I can do is be as healthy as I can mentally, emotionally, physically, so that I can then give myself to the greater whole. Mm-hmm. But even the best version of yourself biblically is just a part of what God's doing.
Right.
1 Corinthians 13, which builds off 1 Corinthians 12, the eye, the ear, the hand, everybody isn't the same. We all are part of a collective body. And then it says we all know in part and we see in part. So me, self-actualized, quote unquote, at 100%,
right,
is still just a part mm-hmm. of what is needed. And not just a part of what is needed for a collective outcome, but also I'm only a part of what I need.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like yeah. even my vertical, you say it's just about Jesus. No, it's Jesus and his people.
Right.
It's never just Jesus, because that's just a vertical deal. That leaves me deficient.
Yeah.
If it's just me and Jesus. Mm-hmm. So help me with that.
Yeah. No, there's so much there. Actually, one of my kids who will remain nameless.
yes. At
just
least
the other,
now.
Yeah. Just the other day was talking about how he wished that we have four boys. So I'm not identifying anybody that way, but how he wished that, you know, he could just do whatever he wants and that we were all, you know, living on our own, independent. And I said, well, that would be difficult, seeing as we come into the world completely dependent. And isn't it interesting how God has constructed the family in such a way that for the first however many years of your life, you are completely dependent. So if we all did what you just said, the human race would cease to exist. And you can see the wheels turning. He was like, you have a point. Yeah.
Way to go deep, Dad. Deep dive.
Hopefully I'd have a point.
Yes.
But yeah, you think of the Bible is framed between two weddings, between the marriage of Adam and Eve and then the marriage of Christ and the church. And the Bible is, the entire narrative of the Bible is encased in this language of family and interdependence and again, connection. And we are, by very nature of being human, we are relational beings. And so we are subhuman when we are trying to function as independent from other people and certainly independent from God. Creating an environment, an ethos, an expectation as a family that we are in this for connectivity. And, you know, we were talking again this morning, you know, Jimmy, we were telling our kids, and my wife and I have great parents, but you know, they have their struggles and we aren't necessarily super close, even just geographically, but we haven't had a ton of help in the sense of, you know, we don't have grandparents living in our home and stuff, and we've moved away and the church has been a surrogate family in a sense. But we were just giving our kids vision the other day a couple months ago at dinner, said, hey, you guys are free as you get older to discern the will of the Lord, to move anywhere on the planet. We will support you. In the absence of real clear leadership and direction, let's stick together.
Yeah.
Because we haven't had the help. Let us help you raise your family and your kids so that, because we're not in this for just ourselves. We're going to, even if we were president of the United States, people won't remember us in 100 years, 200 years. Like, if I could be the most successful person in this life, but if we are not a multi-generational family of followers of Jesus, so let us use our latter years to help you become all that God has called you to be, and then your children after you.
Yes.
It takes a village, and we have had that in the church, but we have not had that in an extended family. So let's do that together. And I know you and Laura have done the same.
Yeah, and maybe that's our wrap for today, because I want to just to tease the next episode that you want to listen to. I think that the challenge with all this is back to sin, which causes pain, which causes us to pull away and make it not work.
Mm-hmm.
So what do we do with attachment pain? I did want to attach to God and to people, and I wanted to be family, but somebody hurt me, or a wound happened, or something that I have a justified reason to pull away.
Mm-hmm.
How do we restore the family? You know, as Jesus prophesied as the Malachi prophesied at the end of the Old Covenant, Jesus answered that in the New Covenant. And I think that I think that that's a worthwhile reality for people. They're listening to us talk, and we're very committed to our families, and we have the joy. I was just all in with this. I was doing my nephew's wedding, and basically, as we got up there, and I'm looking around, and I realized we're a miracle. I mean, for the brokenness of our home and my brothers and sisters, and everybody was there, and now we have, you know, nieces and nephews and grandchildren that love the Lord and all that. We're a miracle. So if you don't believe in God, just look around this room. You know, the miracle of God's ability to carry family and to redeem things is stunning. And it takes work.
Right.
I'll end with this thought, which I won't be able to develop, but maybe we can pick it up in the next one, is that death to self is way underrated.
Mm-hmm.
That the centrality of the beauty of family is people restraining themselves, dying to themselves, giving sacrificially to one another. And it's that sacrifice that creates the beauty that we long for.
That's a good word.
All right. I'm leaving you with that. We're going to pick up the next episode. You don't want to miss it. We're going to talk about family and the pain that makes us who we are.